Muslims in several countries celebrate Eid al-Fitr, a major Islamic feast that marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. Rights groups say Israel is holding close to 600 Palestinians without charge. And a Russian President Vladimir Putin signs a decree to impose tit-for-tat sanctions on unfriendly states. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Muslims in several countries celebrate Eid al-Fitr, a major Islamic feast that marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. Iranians have marked the auspicious occasion with worshippers attending Eid al-Fitr prayers nationwide. Iraq, India, and Pakistan have also commemorated the event. Other Muslim nations observe the Eid on Sunday and Monday. The timing of the occasion can differ in various countries. That depends on the sighting of the new moon, which marks the beginning of the month of Shawwal on the lunar calendar. Eid al-Fitr is an official holiday in all Muslim countries.
The fasting month of Ramadan is over, and Muslims have ushered in the second most important festivity in Islam, Eid al-Fitr, or the Festival of Breakfast. Muslims start their Eid al-Fitr by taking part in congregational prayers themed with bidding farewell to Ramadan and welcoming the Eid.
Eid al-Fitr is a celebration of our months-long endeavor to connect with God more closely than other times of the year by enduring the hardship of fasting. I'm so happy to be able to fast, and Eid al-Fitr is my reward.
I am so happy to mark Eid al-Fitr, but at the same time, I miss the spiritual atmosphere of Ramadan. It's a month when you feel closer to God than ever.
After they complete the Eid al-Fitr prayer, Muslims then visit their relatives and loved ones during the festivity. It's the first time in 2 years that Muslims have marked Eid al-Fitr without COVID curbs, so they can celebrate Eid al-Fitr together.
Over the past 2 years, we were not able to visit the elderly and other relatives. Thanks God, the coronavirus has subsided and we can celebrate Eid al-Fitr with the people we love.
Every year on Eid al-Fitr, Muslims set aside a portion of their annual income, dhabt fitriya, to donate it to the poor. They say this is to spread the happy mood of Eid al-Fitr among the needy.
Zakat al-Fitr is a very small portion of our income, but it makes a significant difference when all affording Muslims join in. This way, the rich and the poor share the festive mood of Eid al-Fitr.
Eid al-Fitr falls on the first day of the lunar month of Shawwal. According to the Islamic lunar calendar, months begin and end depending on the movement of the moon in its orbit around the Earth. And the start of each month depends on the sighting of the new moon the day before. Iran sighted the Eid al-Fitr crescent on the eve of Tuesday, while many other Muslim nations announced the festivity on Sunday and Monday.
Eid al-Fitr is a culmination of 1 month of abstinence from eating and drinking. And that's why Muslims consider it a divine reward for their success in obeying God's order. This year, the festive mood is multiplied as Muslims can celebrate it together without the worries of the pandemic. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Israeli rights groups say the regime is holding around 600 Palestinians in administrative detention, keeping them behind bars without charge or trial. Ha-Mokta Group says that the number is actually the highest since 2016. It says the administrative detainees are arrested on what it calls secret evidence. The group says those detainees are unaware of the accusations against them and are denied the right to defend themselves in court. The so-called administrative detention allows the Israeli regime to indefinitely keep Palestinians behind bars. The practice has drawn widespread international criticism, including from the UN, calling for an end to it over violations of rights of prisoners. In the past years, Palestinian administrative detainees have on various occasions held hunger strikes to protest their jail conditions. Iran's foreign minister says the negotiations to restore the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA have not stopped and are continuing in a different format. In an interview, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Iran and the U.S. are exchanging written messages through the EU representative in the Vienna talks. He said the process is aimed at the removing unilateral U.S. sanctions. The talks began in April last year, but with only a few issues remaining to be settled, the negotiators left the Austrian capital several weeks ago and have not since returned. Amir Abdullahian added that Iran seeks a robust and durable deal, as it has asked Americans to be realistic. The diplomat said the U.S. is fully aware of Iran's red lines and has been notified that the removal of all sanctions and the provision of economic guarantees are among Tehran's key demands. The family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses, say Hamid Nouri, a retired employee of the Iranian judiciary, was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical services. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over alleged human rights violations against members of the anti-terror group Mujahideen Khalq organization back in the 1980s. Videos on social media show MKO members harassing Nouri's family as they enter a court building. The footage shows that Swedish police failed to protect the family. Meanwhile, Nouri's wife laments that Swedish officials did not allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nouri as baseless and described his trial as a political show. The MKO is responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s, including the country's then president and prime minister. Russian President Vladimir Putin issues a new decree imposing retaliatory economic sanctions against, quote, unfriendly countries and entities. The Kremlin says the move is in response to anti-Russia measures taken by some countries and international organizations. Russia will prohibit the export of products and raw materials to people and entities under sanctions. The order also bans transactions with individuals and companies from certain countries and asks Russian counterparties not to fulfill their obligations towards them. The Russian government has 10 days to compile a list of foreign individuals and companies to be blacklisted. The U.S. and the EU and some of their allies have imposed a wave of sanctions on Moscow since it launched a war on Ukraine in late February. Journalist and political commentator Fred Weir joined us with his take on Russia's retaliatory sanctions against Western countries.
I think the Russian idea will be to find some selected targets where it can make its point. The trick in is to hurt the target and not have it blow back on yourself. And one of the things we're learning from all these Western sanctions right now is that there's a tremendous amount of self-inflicted collateral damage in the West, even though they're also hurting Russia. An example of a clever way to do it was the Russians in 2015. They announced a whole series of counter sanctions against the European Union, which was sanctioning them in finance and industry and so on. They banned European food products from Russia, from being imported into Russia. And that hurt European countries who had been major exporters, and it stimulated Russian agriculture so that by this time, like it's only 7-8 years later, Russian agriculture is practically self-sufficient.
Ukraine is turning into an arena for a proxy war between nuclear superpowers, the United States and Russia. The Pentagon has recently said that it is providing Ukrainian armed forces with training on key systems. at U.S. military installations in Germany. Now, fears have grown that the war could spill over to other countries in Europe.
The Pentagon says it's training Ukrainian troops in Germany and other locations in Europe, an announcement that's likely to anger Russia. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said Germany is one of the roughly three locations where over 100 Ukrainian troops are being trained on operating howitzer artillery systems and radars. The troops are set to go back to Ukraine and provide a training to others on how to operate the systems that the United States has recently pledged to the country. Kirby also says the United States is considering training Ukrainian troops on how to use other equipment in a virtual format. The White House has recently called on Congress to provide $33 billion in additional assistance to Ukraine, some two-thirds of which earmarked for military purposes. Washington has already sent millions of dollars worth of weapons and equipment to Ukraine. That's on top of the aid packages other NATO allies have allocated to Kiev.
At a war between these two great superpowers, the U.S. and Russia, would be absolutely disastrous for the entire world with the threat of nuclear war. But in practicality, absolutely, it does mean that. It does mean that just as we have in Syria, where the U.S. will train extremist fighters, the U.S. is functionally at war with the Syrian government and the Syrian people, though perhaps not literally on paper. I think the same thing applies to Ukraine. If the U.S. is going to fund and now actively train people to fight against Russia's special operation in Ukraine, then the U.S. is functionally at war.
Russia has earlier warned that weapons poured into Ukraine from the West will be fair game for its strikes. The United States and other NATO member states had initially said they didn't want to enter into a direct conflict with Russia. Is that the reason why they're helping prolong the war in Ukraine, which in effect is likely to turn into a proxy conflict?
The West's assistance to Ukraine is not limited to military hardware. A recent congressional push to give U.S. President Joe Biden the authority to declare war with Russia has sparked fresh concerns about the possibility of a wider conflict. Washington's intelligence cooperation with Kiev is raising tensions with Moscow as well.
On May 1st, Adam Kinzinger, a Republican congressman representing Illinois' 16th congressional district, introduced a resolution dubbed Authorization for Use of Military Force to Defend America's Allies, or AUMF. If passed, the resolution would enable U.S. President Joe Biden to use his war powers against Russia in case Moscow carries out a chemical or nuclear strike in Ukraine. But in the event of a war, the concept of mutually assured destruction will be on the table, meaning that the two sides, both nuclear powers, will be risking total annihilation. That could explain why both have ruled out the possibility of a direct confrontation. It can also be the reason why the West has resorted to imposing sanctions on Russia and providing Ukraine with assistance. One such example is the spy satellites belonging to the U.S. military and private firms that are gathering intel on Russian military positions and movements in Ukraine and relaying them to the U.S. and its allies, including Kiev itself.
I mean, if there's anything that we learned from the 90s, it's that when NATO gets involved in a war, it is disastrous for the civilians more than anyone else. We saw that in Yugoslavia. And unfortunately, it looks like we may see that again in Ukraine. And if NATO were to become involved, if NATO were to declare war on Russia or even amp up its support for Ukraine, be it money, weaponry, training, whatever it may be, it will be disastrous. And it will make this conflict become more prolonged, which is, I'm sure, what Lockheed Martin and Boeing and the other big corporations in the U.S. military industrial complex want.
These developments are pushing the tensions to the point of no return. What's certain is that a possible war between superpowers won't have a winning side.
The British Prime Minister says his government can't provide enough financial support to ease the pain of the current cost of living in the country for the months ahead.
Because I accept that those contributions from the taxpayer, because that's what it is, taxpayers' money, isn't going to be enough immediately help cover everybody's costs. Of course that isn't going to work in
enough in the short term. So you acknowledge you are not doing everything
there
you
is,
can.
There is more that we can do.
Yes.
But the crucial thing is to make sure we deal with the prices over the medium and long term. Although you're quite right to point out that there is an inflationary risk and it's very severe, it could get worse. And that knocks onto interest rates and that knocks onto the cost of borrowing for everybody. And I'm sorry to say this, but we have to be prudent in our approach. We're not
saying... Johnson rejected the prospect of raising welfare benefits in line with inflation. He argued that such a measure can potentially drive inflation even higher. The Prime Minister also rebuffed the idea of a windfall tax on oil and gas giants, saying the move would discourage energy companies from making investments. Britain is grappling with soaring inflation, which hit a 30-year high of 7% in March. That, coupled with the war in Ukraine, is taking a toll on the British economy. Surging prices are contributing to the biggest squeeze on household incomes since at least the 1950s. Retail sales and consumer confidence have fallen significantly in the past months.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Congratulations to all world Muslims with the arrival of the blessed Eid al-Fitr, marking the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. Our felicitations to all Muslims throughout the world. In the limelight.
With pandemic restrictions eased, a huge rally was held in Toronto opposite the U.S. consulate on April 30, and participants then marched through the streets of Toronto to draw attention to the continued occupation of Al-Quds and Zionist brutalities against innocent Palestinians. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by the staff of Crescent International. This article is published under the heading, "The Streets of Toronto Reverberated with Sounds of Free, Free Palestine on Al-Quds Day Rally." Stay tuned for more. With pandemic restrictions eased, a huge rally was held in Torino opposite the U.S. consulate on April 30, and participants then marched through the streets of Torino to draw attention to the continued occupation of Al-Quds and Zionist brutalities against innocent Palestinians. There is another ritual that has become familiar. Pro-Israeli groups pressure on city officials and threats against the Quds Day rally participants. True to their violent nature, the Zionists have in the past attacked peaceful Quds Day participants, while Zionist organizations make false allegations of rally participants propagating hate. It is shocking that Toronto city officials parrot the nonsensical Zionist allegations against the Quds Day rally participants. If they bother to see who participates in these rallies, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, yes, members of the Jewish community who are anti-Zionist, they would know that the defamatory allegations pro-Israeli groups hurl at the Quds rally are totally false. This year's rally is assumed added significance because people looked forward to participating physically and to condemn Zionist brutalities against the Palestinian people. Rallies were held in all parts of the world, including several cities in North America. In Canada, where Toronto has traditionally had the singular honor of holding the largest rally in North America, this year several other Canadian cities also held their rallies. These included Ottawa, Calgary, Edmonton, and so on. In the U.S., Quds Day rallies were held in Washington, D.C., Chicago, Houston, and Los Angeles, among others. What is remarkable about the Quds Day rallies in North America is that they are attended by people of all faiths and no faith. There is also always a strong presence of members of the Jewish community that oppose the racist ideology of Zionism. Like last year, the Zionists in Occupy Palestine attacked the Holy Sanctuary and barked into the Masjid al-Aqsa with their filthy boots. Tens of thousands of worshippers were prevented from praying inside the sacred mosque. Those inside the mosque were attacked with rubber bullets as well as tear gas. This year, the Zionists escalated their aggressive tactics by using drones to spray sewage water on Muslim worshippers. This reflects the Zionists' filthy minds. They know that sewage water is filthy, it stinks, and it pollutes the Muslims' clothes that renders their worship invalid. This is deliberate. The Zionist aims is to block Muslims from worshipping in Masjid al-Aqsa so that the Zionists can take it over. This is why Al-Quds matters to Muslims and why its complete liberation from the clutches of the Zionists is important. Al-Quds is the first Qibla of Muslims. Since the Zionist entity was illegally implanted in Palestine, trampling upon the rights of the indigenous Palestinian population, the Holy Land has had no peace. Indeed, the entire region has been engulfed in wars and bloodshed ever since. The Palestinians were not even consulted when their land was handed over to the Zionist marauders from Europe. This is what constitutes settler colonialism. The Zionists have repeatedly perpetrated genocide against the Palestinian people. This year, as Muslims were observing the month of Ramadan, Zionist gangs continued to trespass on the holy sanctuary in Al-Quds in violation of all norms of civilized behavior as well as against Judaic law. The Zionists, however, are not constrained by any law or morality. As alien invaders of Palestine, their mission is to steal the land of Palestinians.
The fabricated regime of Israel is a colonial settler entity, like that of the European settlers in North America, Australia, and New Zealand. What makes the case of Palestine even more serious is the location of Masjid al-Aqsa in Al-Quds. Zionism is an evil ideology that all Muslims are obliged to oppose. Further, the Zionists' continued occupation of Al-Quds and deliberately provocative encroachments on the holy sanctuary are an affront to the sensitivities of all Muslims, regardless of where they reside. The Zionist entity must therefore be confronted by not only Muslims, but all fair and justice-minded people everywhere. Zionist injustice cannot be allowed to stand. It must be opposed and stopped. The suffering of the Palestinians, including women, children, and youth, and the indescribable cruelty of the heavily armed Zionists, whether soldiers or settlers, actually read that as illegal squatters, against the Palestinians, have aroused the concern of many people of conscience. This message has to spread more widely. Muslims, Christians, and Jews who participate in such rallies, especially in non-Muslim countries like those in Europe and North America, face the wrath of the regimes there. Even without the Quds Day rallies, Muslims face immense persecution and oppression. Islamophobia is running rampant in Europe and North America. Their claims to freedom of expression are a fraud. The Quds Day rallies are a great opportunity to expose their fraudulent claims to freedom, even if there is the ever-present danger of oppression and persecution. This is a price that has to be paid, because silence in the face of injustice is not an option. Standing up for truth and speaking out against injustice are fundamental obligations of all Muslims.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are focusing on the third sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains about certain details of the reason why he took over the government after Uthman, and he explains and elucidates some of those details in a very beautiful and eloquent manner. We were discussing about the fact that Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he took over the government, it was in a lot of problems because there was a lot of injustice happening, and therefore he had to sort out many issues. Anyways, the situation was such that the people now wanted a guide, wanted someone to give them that right form of governance. They wanted to have that type of leadership that would give them peace and solace and happiness. And therefore they came to Imam Ali alayhi salam, who was like their father, their guide, their leader, their teacher, who they saw in his life was so pure and good. And then the people didn't see anything negative in Imam Ali alayhi salam. So they all rushed to him and they chose him and forced him basically to accept the leadership.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about the reasons why Imam Ali alayhi salam took over the leadership and the wisdom behind it. And we saw that the people, when they came to Imam Ali alayhi salam, they were seeking a safe haven, basically, and flee from the injustices that were happening. And therefore they came to Imam Ali, they rushed to him. You know, they came from all sides. And this itself is a question to ask, that it seems the people were unhappy. The people were not pleased with the status quo. And that's why they rushed to Imam Ali. And Imam Ali alayhi salam explains that the situation was shocking. His house was filled with people from all sides. Not only his house, outside his house, people had pushed themselves inside forcefully. Such that Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who are strong men at that time, even they were crushed and pressed very hardly. You know, they were so frustrated and so much thirsty of that right form of leadership that they even forgot that the Prophet had said that Imam Hussein and Imam Hussein are Sayyidi Shabab al Ahl al Jannah, and that for these are the grandchildren of the Prophet. We should be careful. We shouldn't push them. We shouldn't, just enter the house like this. But people were very thirsty. And it seems that the people came not because the Prophet commanded them, not because they suddenly remembered that the Prophet ﷺ had said, Man kuntu mawlahu fahadha aliyun mawla. That whoever I am his master, this Ali is his master. No, it's not that they remembered that. It was something that was out of their inner thirst, because they had drank the water of justice at the time of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and they realized how thirsty they are. So it was out of their own will, in-depth reasoning that existed inside their hearts, that they came to Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they thought that he is going to help them and he's going to sort out their situation. And it was true. At least this judgment was correct judgment. But how late? How late was this judgment? Imam Ali alayhi salam was there with them always. Always smiling with the people, helping them, working, struggling. If they would only have asked him earlier, and then he would have guided them and helped them and solved their problems and created that system that the Prophet ﷺ had proposed for the people.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Let us come back to our discussion and go through some of the reasons that Imam Ali alayhi salam had in mind while taking up this leadership. The first thing that I would like to mention here is that if you look at the present forms of leadership that exist in the world, the reason why people take these leaderships, normally is because they feel that they have a very good material benefit out of it. Imagine someone who becomes a leader or a president in today's age. You can just look at the world today and see the kings and the presidents and the leaders. Look at their houses. Look at the types of clothes that they wear, the food that they eat, and the type of lifestyle that they have is way beyond the normal average people, let alone the poor people that live in those communities and those societies. That means leadership has become a reason why people just satisfy their material aims and objectives. And you can see the peak of this form of attitude in the American system, whereby the rich people, whereby the government, the Senate, the Congress, all of them are at the service of the 1% rich and filthy people of the world. That's the reason why they are going to that leadership position. They know that there is a lot of material benefit. There is strength, there is power, there is, you know, that sense of honor, fake honor that they feel, and all of that glitter. But Imam Ali alayhi salam, you look at his lifestyle. His lifestyle was such that it was equal to one of the poorest people of the community at that time. And he was the leader. He didn't even give himself the luxury of extra things, even extra clothes or something, or even soft food. Inshallah, I will discuss about this special lifestyle of Imam Ali alayhi salam within his leadership, inshallah. And we'll see that special difference that exists in Imam Ali's system of justice and the systems of justice that we have in the world today, the so-called systems of leadership and justice that actually aren't really that. I would like to congratulate the people today, especially those who are celebrating Eid. For some countries, it might be Eid today, and therefore we pray for them and we pray for each other for the greatness and progress of the Muslim Ummah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Scams relating to digital coins are growing, but data reveals that British authorities are making record seizures of assets too. We now present you an article written by Rob Davis. The piece is titled "Crypto Crime Wave Forces UK Police Online to Pursue Ill-Gotten Assets." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. In July 2021, specialist police officers in Manchester, England, swooped on an international cryptocurrency scam, seizing USB sticks and an online safe containing £16 million worth of digital coins, mostly Ethereum. A month earlier, Leicestershire police had confiscated 10 types of cryptocurrency after raiding the home of a drug dealer who used digital assets to buy and sell Class A drugs. Both operations pale in comparison to the Metropolitan Police's record cryptocurrency haul of the same year, worth £180 million. But all three, and many more besides, are part of a spreading crypto crime wave, laid bare today by a series of Freedom of Information requests. The Guardian requested data from the 45 regional police services in the United Kingdom, asking for a breakdown of cryptocurrency seizures since 2017. The information sent back by the 27 forces that responded reveals a big shift. There has been a significant increase in the number of raids and a proliferation in the types of digital coin criminals are using to invest the proceeds of their activities. More than half of the police forces that responded seized crypto assets during 2021, confiscating or restricting access to 22 different types of digital currency. This was a significant increase on 2020, when 4 types of cryptocurrencies were seized by 8 police services. The figure was even lower in 2019, when only 2 types of digital currency were seized. While the best-known digital currencies such as Bitcoin and Ethereum featured more than any others, the figures reveal the increasing popularity among convicted and suspected criminals of much less well-known rivals. Gervais Grigg, who spent 23 years with the FBI and now works as Chief Technology Officer for the data consultancy firm China Analysis, which helps private companies and law enforcement bodies trace the movement of cryptocurrencies, says Bitcoin is still key. It's digital gold. You've seen this emergence of Ethereum, stable coins, cryptocurrency pinned to a real-world asset, and a much more diverse market. As a result, you're going to find more of those currencies in the pockets of criminals, because they're taking them from people. In the Leicestershire case, police emerged with assets including Engine Coin, Polkadot, New, and even Chiliz, the crypto token sold to football fans to enable them to access perks and vote on decisions at their football club. In Wales, the South Wales Regional Organised Crime Unit seized 8 cryptocurrency assets, including one called Cake, while its counterpart in the South West confiscated 7, including the luxury coin. Phil Harris, who coordinates the National Police response to crypto crime, says, "It's an emerging field that's come at us like a tidal wave, and policing has to adapt with the times." He added, "It's a big learning curve, but we're doing well." He says 300 police officers have been trained in crypto crimes, with hundreds more due to receive instruction. But the scope of the challenge is even greater than outlined by the Guardian's Freedom of Information requests. He says while some services haven't made seizures themselves, most are involved in investigations with police officers working on cases featuring between 35 and 40 types of digital coin. He says it's not just investments and theft. In some extreme cases, it's terrorism financing. It can be purchasing of child abuse images, money laundering. We're seeing a huge span of cases across law enforcement. Most police services don't disclose the amount of cryptocurrency involved for fear that other bad actors, armed with such granular detail, could spot when seizures had taken place. Leicestershire Police said it might give them forewarning of an investigation that could affect them, allowing them to take steps to hide their ill-gotten gains. However, Dyfed Powys Police in Wales, which patrols a mostly rural area in which Llanelli is the largest town, told The Guardian it had taken possession of 82 bitcoins in 2021, with a value of £2.5 million at the most recent price. When the police do confiscate such digital assets, they're not well equipped to store them themselves. Instead, Avon and Somerset Police explains, they contract the job out, storing the bounty in a secure wallet with a third-party provider. They decline to name the companies involved, citing security reasons. There is a danger of workers at crypto exchanges being targeted. In 2017, Pavel Lerner, a British-based exchange employee, was abducted by gun-toting men wearing balaclavas in Ukraine. He was only released after a ransom was paid. Every police service that responded to the Freedom of Information request referred to this case as a reason why they would not disclose holders of seized cryptocurrencies. Avon and Somerset Police say, the above incident is not the only one of its kind. As such, providing information to the wider public about the volume of assets stored and where they are stored increases the risk of cyber attacks, insider threat, and other hostile actions by those who may wish to infiltrate either the supplier or law enforcement. In theory, the growing attraction of cryptocurrency to criminals is obvious. Large amounts of money can be sent across borders quickly into jurisdictions that do not necessarily cooperate with British law enforcement. Though, according to Gervais Grigg, criminals should not get overconfident. Transactions that take place on the blockchain are by their very nature logged. That means with the right time and right resources, they can be traced and perpetrators apprehended long after crimes have been committed. On the dark web, mixing services are available that allow criminals to launder their cryptocurrency, blending it with other types of assets to scatter the paper trail and throw investigators off their tail. But Gervais Grigg says that determined, well-resourced investigators can still get there in the end. He says tracing tools have got better and data availability is better. He claims the growing number of seizures in Britain is not just a reflection of more crime, but of growing ability of police forces in Britain to stop it. In addition, he points out the legitimate crypto market has grown faster than the volume of crime-related transactions has. According to Chainalysis, illicit crypto addresses received $14 billion during 2021, a record sum but an all-time low in terms of share of total volume, at just 0.15 percentage point. Yet, as long as the crypto world is expanding rapidly, the challenge for law enforcement will grow alongside it. A separate Freedom of Information disclosure, shared with The Guardian, reveals a significant increase in reports of crypto-related fraud last year. According to the City of London Police, there were 9,607 such reports made to the National Reporting Hotline Action Fraud last year, up from 5,581 the year before, and up from 3,558 in 2019. Victims who were disproportionately likely to be under the age of 35 and male flagged financial losses of more than £200 million. David Gerrard, author of The Attack of the 50-Foot Blockchain, says more crypto simply equals more crime, He says more people are using the stuff. He adds, there are minor coins known as bad coins for everything these days. He says, there will be a lot more scams because more people are promoting it. Times are tough, people are worried, so they prey to false hope and get-rich-quick schemes. But Phil Aris, who coordinates the National Police response to crypto crime, points out that the greater the public's interest in cryptocurrency, the greater also the awareness and understanding among the police officers trying to prevent ordinary people from becoming victims. Phil Aris says, the expansion of crypto in the consciousness of the wider public also affects police officers. You only have to go to the tube and you see advertisements. Crypto companies are sponsoring sports teams. On crypto.com, you've got Matt Damon endorsing it, claiming there's an awareness that permeates and in some ways the challenge of training police officers is easier now than it has ever been before.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Oh Lord, here I am pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we would like to convey our most warm and sincere congratulations to all of our esteemed listeners all over the Muslim and non-Muslim world. Because, as you know, in a lot of Muslim countries and in a lot of non-Muslim countries, today is the day of Eid al-Fitr, the day of Eid al-Fitr, which comes at the end of the month of Ramadan. Today on Hadith of the Day, in connection with this most auspicious and great day, we would like to recite for you a beautiful hadith and tradition which has been narrated from the 10th Imam of the family of the Prophet alayhim as-salam, Imam al-Hadi, Imam Ali al-Naqi alayhi salam. In this beautiful tradition, which has been narrated in the book Biharul Anwar, the famous book of traditions and hadith, volume 98, page 351, the Imam says, "Innamal a'yadu arba'ah." There are four Eids, there are four festivals for our Shia, for our followers, for the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. In contrast to, let's say, the other followers of the other Muslim sects, for some of which these Eids and these festivals are inapplicable, as you'll see just in a second. The first is the Eid that we are celebrating today, Eid al-Fitr, the Eid that comes at the end of the month of Ramadan. Wal Adha, the second is the Eid al-Adha, the Eid which is known in some countries as Eid al-Qurban, which commemorates the sacrifice that the great prophet Abraham made when he was asked to sacrifice his son. And the story, you know how it goes. This is the second Eid for the followers of the Ahlul Bayt and the family of the prophet. The next is Eid al-Ghadir. The Eid al-Ghadir is a reference to the event of Ghadir when the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam designated Ali ibn Abi Talib as his successor in front of a large gathering of Muslims in the valley near the pond of Ghadir on his way back from his final pilgrimage, Hajjatul Wida, which is a very famous event and has been narrated in the books of Hadith, and the Shias commemorate it and mark it as a very important day in their calendar. This is the Eid which is singled out here and which distinguishes the Shia and the followers of the Ahlul Bayt from the other followers of the other Islamic sects. Finally, the Imam says, Wal Jum'ah, the day of Friday. The Friday, which is the last day of the week, is also considered an Eid. It's also considered a festival. It's also considered a holiday. It's not a day in which we should work. It's a day when we should take off. We should celebrate it. We should commemorate it. We should be happy on this day. Unfortunately, in a lot of Muslim countries, the Friday has become a normal day, become a normal work day. We go to school, we go to work, whatever. But however, according to Islamic traditions, right, this is not proper, as has been referenced in the Quran, you're well aware of it. So this brings this hadith to a close. As you saw, the Imam alayhi salam mentions 4 days as days of celebration for the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, Eid al-Fitr, Eid al-Adha, Eid al-Ghadir, and the day of Friday. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We once again congratulate you on this most happy and auspicious day. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to European countries stating that they will cut off their purchase of Russian oil and gas, that has not come to fruition. There are at least 10 countries that have continued to not only purchase their energy needs from Russia, but have also complied with the Russian demand that it be paid in rubles. Even though the EU has